Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you are about to listen to our latest episode of This Week in Law. We're so glad that you joined us because with us today are Mike Listener and Brian Carver, co-founders of the Free Law Project. We're going to talk a lot about that project and about access to court documents in general, public information that sometimes can get people in trouble when they access it without permission or in the wrong way. So we're going to go deep on that. We're also going to talk about some good fair use developments, bad news for Groove Shark. We're going to talk about Apple Pay and Apple Watch and the privacy overtones there. Musical Mice 2, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 275, recorded September 12th, 2014. First rule of Mouse Club. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law. That's what you're here for. That's what we're going to do here for the next, couple of hours this show can run. We've got a great, great panel of folks with us today and a really interesting and exciting lineup of topics. I'll go ahead and introduce them to you right now. My co-host, Evan Brown, is here with us. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. It's great to be here. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. And what we have for you today is a double header of folks who are involved with the Free Law Project. Both of them are founders of that project, and they can tell us a whole lot more about it. Brian Carver is here. He is a professor at the Berkeley School of Information. Hello, Brian.
Hi.
Good to see you. Great you could be on the show.
Thanks.
And Mike Listener is with us, too. And Mike was one of Brian's students. And the project that they're involved in was a project of his while he was working with Brian. So that's really cool. Hello, Mike.
Hi. Great to be here.
Why don't you guys start out telling us about the Free Law Project and why you started it and when you started it?
Mike, why don't you take that one?
Sure. So the Free Law Project is something that Brian and I started about a year ago officially as a nonprofit. But we've been doing this and exploring things in this sort of realm for just about 5 years now. Brian was a professor I had when I was at UC Berkeley, and he sort of pitched a final project to me. And I took that project and sort of started rolling with it and built out Court Listener, which is a website. Court Listener has millions of court opinions, and we're moving into oral arguments and other things like that. And I've just been sort of building that and working on that part-time and now full-time for the last 5 years. And so I think that's the crux of the history.
Great. Yeah.
Eliding a few things.
Sure. I would add that it also now, Free Law Project, it serves as sort of an umbrella organization for all of our efforts. And another thing that we're working on that people might have heard of is the Recap browser extensions. Those were started by some folks at Princeton at their Center for Information Technology Policy. And that was about 5 years ago. They just recently celebrated that anniversary. But Recap, if you haven't used it, is a browser plugin if you use Firefox or Chrome. And you, when you're using the PACER system, the system from in which all of the federal district court and appellate court dockets reside and the documents on those dockets, Recap will tell you if another Recap user has already paid for that document and uploaded it to our archive, and the little blue Recap icon shows up on your docket so that you could choose, if you like, to click that and get the document for free from our archive rather than paying PACER's 10 cents a page charge. And of course, sort of the other end of that is that as RECAP users pay for documents that are not yet in the archive, they get uploaded so that the next person doesn't have to pay for it. And through that process, there's now over 3 million documents, I think, and close to a million different cases, I think, in the RECAP archive.
That is really cool. And our timing couldn't be better to have you on the show because there's been a lot of controversy with PACER just over the last couple of weeks. And I'm going to go ahead and call it a copyright-related controversy. So let's get into it from that standpoint. This is a copyright-related controversy in an unconventional way, because what we're talking about here is public domain documents, all of the court documents that are filed with the federal court system and the decisions of the various federal courts in the United States are all public domain, but they're not that easily accessible. PACER has been around for, what, 25 years or something along those lines. I certainly remember using it back when I first started to practice law, and it hasn't changed much in that time. It is it has always been a pay service where you could get filings and opinions if you knew precisely what you were looking for. At 10 cents a page. So it can get pretty pricey. And PACER has taken flack over the years, both for having this paywall infrastructure for access to all the federal court materials that it houses, and also for its pricing and, you know, whether it is really following its congressional mandate to cover its costs. And that's it. Have I teed that up, do you think, sufficiently? Brian, can you tell us a bit more about the background of PACER and sort of people's thoughts about the system?
Sure. You're right. That is a system that's been around for a long time. And in some ways, it's very good at what it does. Lawyers that work in the federal courts have become familiar with it, or and, you know, if for filing documents in the sort of parallel ECF system, it does its job, right? We're able to have electronic filing and delivery of documents. The charges, you know, get some criticism. I guess we feel like the courts ought to be able to fund their activities, and there's nothing wrong with that. I guess we would prefer that Congress simply allocate them the money they need to operate, because as it stands now, the burden of supporting the court's activities falls on the public that wants to access public records. And so if we could move away from that, we'd certainly be happier. But there's been a long history of folks who have wanted to try to liberate some of these documents. Famously, when they did a pilot project where they were going to provide free access at several regional libraries spread out across the country, Aaron Swartz got the idea to create a script that would download lots of these documents for free. And as soon as the courts saw, you know, many millions of documents going off of the site, they shut down the public access at the libraries. And there was even a FBI investigation of Aaron before they determined these are public records. There's really nothing wrong with downloading them, even if you happen to download a lot. And so
Let me ask you something before you go forward. So obviously, Aaron Swartz was subject to an FBI investigation for his mass downloading of PACER documents. And now you guys have done this browser extension RECAP that is allowing people to share those documents that they paid for with others who are looking for them. Sounds like a really cool tool. Have you had communication with the folks at the federal court system about recap? Do they like it? Do they not like it? Do they see it as some kind of threat that could result in an FBI investigation at some point?
So there is some indication that they're well aware of recap, and it is a five-year-old project. There was for some time a notice on many of the login pages at the district courts informing users of the recap extension by name, but not in order to encourage them to use it, but in order to warn them that open source software is, you know, sometimes subject to security concerns. I think that's a little bit of a scare tactic. And then also to remind them that if you are using a Pacer account that has free access because either you're a pro se litigant or for some other reason have been given a fee waiver, that in those circumstances, it would not be appropriate to share your documents with others in that way. But the Pacer system at Pacer.gov for the longest time in their FAQ had a statement saying that information in the Pacer system are public records, and sort of, you know, what you do with them after you retrieve them can be done. You can redistribute them without permission from Pacer. I actually just noticed this week that FAQ answer has disappeared off of their site. They did a reorganization of their frequently asked questions, and somehow that one didn't make the cut. So I don't know if that represents a change in the administrative office of the court's view, but I think for years now they've been telling us these are public records that people can redistribute without permission. So I'm relying on that.
I think one thing to add to that too is the although they may not like the recap add-ons, there's no real way for them to detect that it's there, and there's no real way to stop the recap add-on from doing its thing, technically speaking, because once the document is downloaded to your browser, then we send it away. So from the government's perspective, it just looks like any other person downloading documents. So, you know, short of going into court and making us stop that way, from a technical perspective, it's, you know, pretty invisible.
And so far, there's been no contact from the federal court system to the Internet Archive challenging them for archiving the documents?
No.
No, that's none good. That we've heard
that.
Yeah.
No DMCA takedown notices yet. It hasn't become that kind of a copyright issue. So, again, this isn't quite so much a copyright issue as a transparency in government, and how are we going to structure our access to public domain government documents. Pacer has been much in the news lately because they decided, spur of the moment, without really much notice at all, about 24 hours notice, if all the reading I've done on this is accurate, before they were going to do away with everything in their database before, is it 2012? I mean, really, that's how far that, you know, they're going to drop everything except the most current 2 years?
It varies by court, and mm-hmm. there are five courts that were affected, four of them at the appellate level, the 2nd, 7th, 11th, and federal circuits, and then one bankruptcy court out of the Central District of California. What Pacer's been telling us is that these courts used a legacy system that was not compatible with Pacer Next Gen, some upgrades that they're doing. And so they looked at cases that had been closed and decided to take those offline because for some reason they didn't feel they could migrate them to the new system. That's sort of the technical details of why that migration is not possible has not been discussed. And a lot of technical people have been a little confused and irritated by that because sort of database migrations are fairly commonplace things that a lot of people have to deal with. But at any rate, there were some courts. It is as recent as 2012 that is the cutoff date, particularly the Federal Circuit. There's so many people interested in patent cases that community has been particularly disturbed that they might be missing documents from cases that recent. And then there was an interesting article by the BBC that pointed out that this includes many important civil rights cases out of the Second Circuit. Now Justice Sonia Sotomayor was previously on the Second Circuit. And so all of the cases that she decided while she was there would be included in the cases that have been taken offline. And, you know, when she went through her confirmation hearing, there was quite a lot of interest in scrutinizing her record and going back and looking at how she decided these cases in the Second Circuit. And when you take several hundred thousand documents offline, as they have, when this comes up next time, you know, when the next person is nominated for a Supreme Court position, if they come from the Second, Seventh, 11th, or Federal Circuits, you know, we won't be able to engage in exactly the same sort of scrutiny, or at least not as easily, right? The Pacer folks have said that they will continue to make the documents available, but not online. And so the process for retrieving these is burdened, to say the least. A librarian out of the University of North Carolina's law school did some research to find out what exactly am I going to have to do now to request these cases. And they have a blog post about this, and it's frankly absurd. The fees are going to be extremely high, and sometimes you have to fax somebody a request and wait a couple weeks. And so, you know, and do it on a case-by-case basis. And so, you know, comparing that to the online access that we're accustomed to, it's as if they don't exist at all.
Brian, I always try to make sure that if I get indignant about something that I'm being well reasoned by it. And so what I see is a couple of ways of being upset by this. One is just the fact that these cases were actually taken offline, you know, that there are big chunks of data missing from a few jurisdictions now. But then there's also the larger, more abstract question of principle, the fact that this could have happened. So which is it? I'm sure we need to be upset a little bit about both of them, but which should we be more upset, the principle or the fact that it actually happened? Because, you know, I've used Pacer for years, and my sense is that a great portion of it is useless stuff. And I'm not trying to minimize its importance or be diminutive in any way, but it's just like, you know, docket number 237 minute order on plaintiff's request for extension of time, you know, it's granted. And so that's of no real consequence. That's not going to help us determine whether the next Supreme Court justice is eligible to sit on the bench in that way. So really, honestly, how important should we be about the particular fact that this has been taken off versus the larger, just more principled idea that this has been able to happen with the government provided technology infrastructure?
Yeah, I think you'd be equally justified in being indignant on either basis. On a principled basis, I believe that, you know, government has a public access obligation. And this is a failure of that obligation, in my view. And it actually may even be a technical violation of the E-Government Act. They say that they've only taken off closed cases, but the E-Government Act requires them to maintain online the records of all closed cases for at least 1 year after they're closed. And it's not clear to me yet, right, whether that is true yet. We could even be talking about a violation of the law. I think you could also be upset about this particular set of facts for several different reasons. One is the recency of the documents involved and the relative importance of some of these jurisdictions. You know, if it had been five bankruptcy courts, maybe you would have a harder time getting worked up about it. But that it includes four important appellate courts, I think, you know, makes it a bigger issue. And that we received no notice that this was happening, that it was just sort of announced, it is a sort of separate concern. But maybe the larger issue is it's kind of indicative of government technology failures more broadly. I mean, healthcare.gov is still on everyone's mind, and we have this impression that the government can't seem to do large technology projects. And why is that? Here in California, we had a statewide case management system that we spent almost $500 million on and then had to just say, stop, don't spend any more. It's not going to ever work. And so when the public sees, you know, why is it that Pacer can't migrate documents from one database to another? This is something that industry has to deal with all the time. We sort of lose confidence in their ability as stewards of this very important information.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, if I can add one more thing, too. Like, you know, we talk about these, like, minute orders that are practically just a sentence, right? And how maybe they're not at all, like, interesting in themselves. But something that I think gets lost with the Pacer system on the whole is the sorts of, like, an incredible, like, oversight and powerful things you could do if we had bulk data. For example, even with these minute orders, say that we could look at, you know, the quantity of these orders. Is it going up over time? Is one judge more prone to doing these kinds of orders than another? You know, that kind of analysis has been totally unavailable, basically due to Pacer. And this makes it worse, makes it basically impossible forever. And that kind of analysis can really lead to a lot of, you know, interesting sort of like facts about, you know, the system, about individual judges, about all kinds of different things that we just don't have. So,
right. So you're totally correct on that, Mike. And for our listeners who aren't lawyers, the difference between a minute order and a regular federal court order is volume. A minute order is a few brief sentences and a directive, you know, you shall do this or this shall happen. An order is more like an opinion that you might see from a court of appeal sometimes. And in the federal court, the federal trial court's orders actually get read and followed by the other federal trial courts. So they can have a precedential effect. So it would be a very interesting thing to know if a judge were doing mostly minute orders or were taking the time to or was taking the time to actually write things out and put their reasoning on the record and in public and available for others to see. The other thing I was thinking as you all were talking is you never know, and I'm kind of joking around about this, of course, but you never know what people are going to do with that data. Maybe, Evan, someone would find that little boring minute orders would be a really, really effective Apple Watch app that would work with your healthcare data and help you sleep better at night because there's just nothing better for knocking you out, like reading a flurry of minute orders. So, I jest, but you never know what someone's going to do with that public domain data, that's true, right?
Yeah. That's actually... you know, truth is stranger than fiction. There was an app or website a couple of days ago that came out that just makes it reads through opinions and makes haiku. So you know, it looks at sentences that have what 17 syllables or whatever, and then you get a haiku automatically generated.
That's great.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And the other thing that we're not really addressing here is the charge that Pacer builds in. There are a lot of people who think that the 10 cents a page is outrageously high based on the cost to actually run the system. And, you know, I don't know what the accurate number is. I've seen a bunch of different numbers in the articles I've read on the system over the last week, but there seems to be a thought that it costs about $20 million a year to run Pacer, but they may be making over $100 million a year in fees. Or somewhere close to it. So there seems to be a disconnect between the mandate that they have from Congress to charge just as much as it costs to cover administrative costs and to try and make these materials as available to as many people as possible. Evan, do you see a problem with the fee structure of Pacer?
I don't have any insight into the real economics. I would defer to Brian and Mike on that for any research they may have done or communications. But just applying a healthy dose of common sense to it, given the fact that in the consumer space, in the private marketplace, we see, of course, Moore's Law in effect, storage costs going down, bandwidth costs should be going down. So, you know, what is it that's continuing to cause the increase in the pricing here? You know, electricity, perhaps, you know, I don't think that the cost of the powering the data center ought to have changed that much. But again, this is all just speculation. I'm applying, you know, things that we observe in everyday life, and these services like this at least ought to stay stable and, you know, in an ideal situation would come down when we think of the kind of costs that go into to providing this. Also, the efficiencies of generating the scanned documents in the first place. A lot of the stuff is actually filed electronically. So unlike the old days when, you know, the courts actually had to scan these documents that were just filed by paper. So in a number of different ways, the cost would seem to be going down. But again, I don't have any real insight into the economics. It would just be nice if it were cheaper.
I can tell you one thing they're not spending the extra money on, a Johnny Ive developed UI. I mean, I think it looks the same as it did when I started using it in law school.
It's good to be nostalgic sometimes, you know.
Yes,
dirt style web development.
You don't have to use Internet Archive's Wayback Machine to see what Pacer used to look like. Let's just put it that way.
You know, because it is fun to go to the Space Jam website, you know, the Michael Jordan Bugs Bunny movie, because that's, right. I guess, that's, so you can just go to pacer.gov instead for that.
So Brian, what do you think about the cost and economics?
Yeah, no, it is clear that Pacer is not incentivized to lower their costs to operate the system because they're running 214 different instances of it. I mean, it's right to call it a system because it is, you know, every single district court, every single bankruptcy court, every single appellate court in the federal system runs their own instance of this software, sometimes slightly differing versions of the software and sometimes customized a little bit for their unique situation. But that's an enormous waste of resources. Everybody is moving to the cloud and combining resources into fewer and fewer servers. And for 20 years, Pacer has kept going with this distributed model. I mean, part of that is that courts are their own little kingdoms and they like to make their own rules and do things their own way. And it is very tough to herd those cats. But if they didn't have this slush fund of Pacer fees to support it, then they would at least be motivated to say, okay, wait a minute, what's the most cost effective way to run a system like this? And I guess, you know, on the UI and in general the system and its usability, I'm certainly concerned about that. But I also don't think that government ought to be in the business of providing the public with all these add-on goodies that third parties are really better suited to do. What mm-hmm. the courts are at root are publishers. Right. The one thing they do that nobody else can do is produce those opinions and produce the documents that are filed with them. And so what they really need to be good at is publishing. And so I would rather see them not spend money on UI, but spend money on machine friendly formats for the documents and get us out of the closed world of PDFs or bulk downloads of all the data. Let the third party providers, be they commercial or nonprofits like us, take those documents and we'll make a pretty UI to put on the front end of them, and others will, if we could just get our hands on the documents. Right now, they've made it cost prohibitive for us anyway to get all the documents.
Right. Well, let's talk about that aspect of the Free Law Project. How much of the Pacer database do you have at this point?
It's hard to say. They don't. We've spent some time trying to estimate exactly how big the Pacer database is. And if you go on Wikipedia, there's estimates in there too. I think the last number we came up with was somewhere around 100 million documents. Is that right, Brian? Is that what you remember too?
No, I think we think it's around 700 million documents in the whole system. Probably a little more than that.
Yeah. So it's an incredible quantity of content, and it's easily the biggest government database that's behind a paywall. So what do we have? We have about 3.5 million items, and so do we have a lot of it? No, not really. But the way we get it is via our users actually looking for a document, actually purchasing a document. So the stuff that we do have should be, you know, to some extent, the more important stuff, the stuff people have actually wanted at some point.
And right. Did I read correctly that some of the stuff you have is what Aaron Swartz pulled down in that that period of time when he had the access to the library in California? Is that right?
I don't think we have that.
Or maybe that was that at least recap? Did you populate recap with some of that? Maybe I just dreamt.
Yeah, I don't think that ended up in the recap database. I'm not positive. But I think the whole deal with the FBI getting involved and people got a little skittish maybe. I'm not positive on that though.
Yeah, I think we have access to the Swartz archive as a separate body of data. And I think, you know, our dream is to get the 2.5 million opinions on Court Listener integrated with the 3.5 million documents we've got in the recap archive. And then, sure, let's bring in the Swartz material as well. And little by little, you know, we want to put the entirety of U.S. case law on the internet for the public for free.
That's a huge goal, and we hope that you accomplish it. First of all, we should put our first MCLE passphrase into the show for this episode. We put these phrases into the show in case you are listening for continuing legal or other professional credit. If you need more information about that, you can go to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv, find the This Week in Law page there, and we've got lots of information about the different jurisdictions where lawyers at least have to comply with legal education requirements. And we put these phrases in case your oversight body needs to see that you actually watched or listened to the show. So our first one's going to be magical minute orders. Jot that down. Remember it for later. Could come up. Let's talk about the ways in which you're growing Recap and the Free Law Project. So Recap requires people to download and use a browser extension. You also have something called JurisScraper. Tell us about that, Mike.
Sure, yeah. So JurisScraper is a project we've been doing for about 5 years now. I think it's in its third incarnation. And basically what it does is there's all of these court websites. And they do actually, outside of Pacer, a lot of courts will post all of their opinions. And sometimes they'll also post things like the audio from, you know, an oral argument inside the courthouse. And those can actually be pretty fun to listen to also. So what JurisScraper does is it currently goes to 193 of these court websites, and it grabs the latest content. It does this every hour of every weekday. And so you can use it yourself. It's open source. You can install it and start getting the same content. And it just goes out and it gets all the latest stuff and it puts it into our Court Listener database. And at the end of the day, you can get email alerts or, you know, do your legal research on all of the newest content, which is really, I think that's a big advantage we have. A lot of other systems, it takes a couple days to get content. But we usually have, you know, the latest Supreme Court cases, the latest any Supreme Court within a state. You know, Alabama's Supreme Court, we have their latest stuff, you know, within about half an hour from when it comes up. So.
And this was recently.
And the scraping that you're doing there, just to clarify, is not of the Pacer database. It's of the things that courts are making available outside of Pacer. So unless you were somehow overburdening their system, you're not finding yourself in an FBI investigation kind of scenario there.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we have yet to have any problems with the courts coming and saying, who are you? And we don't hide who we are at all with this system. We, you know, the system very clearly says who we are, and it's never been a problem. We've thought about scraping Pacer, but it's a very scary thing to write a program that automatically gets content that should be free, but sometimes costs a dime per page. I wouldn't want to be the one with the credit card backing that up.
Yes, good point.
JuraScraper also just recently passed something of a milestone because we were able to announce that we now do have coverage of the courts of last resort of all 50 states. We originally started with the federal appellate courts and then the Supreme Court and filled in various federal courts of special jurisdiction, like the Court of Claims and things like this. But it's been a long project to hit those courts of last resort in all 50 states. Some states, without picking on anyone, have very difficult websites to parse. And so it's taken longer to get set up to do those. But now, you know, no matter what jurisdiction you're interested in, we try to have coverage of the material for you.
That's wonderful. So anything else you want to add on this topic before we move on, guys? It's such an important topic, and we're so glad that you're doing the work. We want to give you, you know, just the opportunity to promote anything that you think people need to be doing above and beyond using ReCap. Is there anything, obviously, you guys are a nonprofit. Do you take donations?
Yes, we do take donations. Mm-hmm. And I guess the thing that I would say is, one, if you ever use Pacer, you're wasting your money if you don't have ReCap installed. That's the one big takeaway. And I guess the other one is that, you know, everything is open source. We do all of our work in the open. All of our data we give away for free. So if you ever want to play with legal data or if you want to get involved, get in touch. We have, you know, developer evangelists and everything, and we love when people get in touch with us.
Yeah, I'd say that address is courtlistener.com/donate if you want to contribute to the
right.
But then also we do have a lot of volunteer developers who contribute, and so we're on GitHub at github.com/freelawproject, and you can check out the source code for everything we do, and if you know some Python or want to learn, you might find a way to contribute in that way. Yeah.
And you're not only helping people get access to the law, but you could be building entrepreneurial businesses out of that data too. There's, like you said, there's a developer kit to work with your data, Mike. So if someone wanted to, you know, put a super great UI on the database that you have, that there wouldn't be any bar to doing that, right?
That's right, yeah. And people get in touch with us constantly. Our data is possibly our most popular feature. If you look on our homepage, it's usually hundreds of thousands of hits. You know, maybe it's about 100,000 a day. I'm forgetting my stats, but it gets a ton of traffic, and it's super easy to get involved with and use for your whatever you want to do.
Evan, you think there's...
You have reminded me you reminded me of a couple other things, right? Is what Mike's talking about there is we now have an API so that people can access the data programmatically. And if there's not non-programmers out there, an application programming interface or API is just a way for computers to talk to computers. And so when we put that API on our data, it enables third parties who want to make use of it in some way to do so very easily. And so one example is, the Sunlight Foundation has this alert tool they call Scout that lets you keep up with changes in the legislation that you might be following or other areas. But they had never done court opinions before. And once we had our API, they were able to just plug that in. And now you can also get alerts, the same sort that we offer, about court opinions as well. Or maybe a more interesting example might be the State Decoded Project is trying to make nice, readable versions of state codes available. And I think it's a VA code is Virginia's code that they've done. And they integrated our API so that when you're looking at a particular statute, over in the sidebar, they pull in opinions from Court Listener that are interpreting that statute. And so it's nice to be able to read the law, but you know, usually what really matters to you is how does the court interpret that law? And so having that just, you know, a couple inches away that you can click on makes their site, you know, more useful to their users. And it's something that's, you know, became possible once we created that API.
That is really cool. We've managed to have, go ahead.
Another thing that you mentioned, you know, though, is that it also does sort of level the playing field for startups or legal technology businesses. Something that I frequently say is that there's currently an enormous waste of money happening where legal technology startups are getting kind of hot, and VCs are funding various startups to do this, but almost all of them need the documents. Almost all of them want, you know, the legal data to get started, and most of them are having to go out and buy that data over and over and over again, and they're wasting, you know, what little resources they have on that when they could be spending their money on whatever their whiz-bang feature is that made them want to do a startup to begin with. And so we're hopeful if we could just get everything and give it away for free, that it'll have this, you know, amazing impact on the startups in the legal tech space, because they'll have a head start on doing whatever it is that they want to do.
Yeah, as you were talking, it reminded me about the way people get frustrated of buying their music over and over again, their movies over and over again in different formats. I'm sure that applies to rounding up usable legal data as well. And I'm surprised we've managed to have this whole conversation without mentioning Westlaw and Lexis, who are the two big players in paid access to searchable legal information. Evan, do you think that they see this kind of progress as a threat?
I was thinking about Westlaw and Lexis, but I didn't dare utter those words because I was afraid that to Brian and Mike, that might be swearing. So, I would trust that Brian and Mike see this at a pretty fundamental level of just sort of the same problem with Pacer. It's a question of economics and access rather than anything that's inherent in an ownership of the content itself, you know, rather than some sort of proprietary interest like copyright with the federal statutes like that. So, you know, when we look at it this way, it becomes a big economics problem, and it seems like the economics of it is intractable from the issue because, you know, if you guys are being so so ambitious as to offer this for free, you got to be getting money from somewhere. And I trust that's got to be more than the donations that would come in from, what was it, freelawproject.com? Or what was it, Brian, again?
Well, the donate page itself is at courtlistener.com/donate. But you're right. We put up that donate button, and it turned out the world was not sitting there with their wallet in hand waiting to make donations. We are a sort of niche issue that some people understand its importance, but maybe not everybody. And so we're currently seeking support from large foundations that might take an interest in government transparency sort of issues. And if somebody from one of those organizations is out there listening, please get in touch. We do need more support, and it's actually takes away from our adding new features and doing new things because we're having to struggle to find that funding. But I guess I could go back to the Westlaw and Lexis thing and say, I run into guys from those companies at conferences all the time, and they're very nice people, right? I have nothing against them, and I don't really think at the end of the day they're very scared of us. they shouldn't be.
Right.
Because I think those who are have thought about it in those entities know that the day is coming when the basic legal data is going to be commoditized and is going to be free. And I don't think they really see themselves as offering a service that only provides that data. And instead, they've got decades and billions of dollars invested in nice legal research tools on top of that, third-party resources, copyrighted treatises that we're not going to be able to put on our site because we don't have a license for that sort of thing, you know. And so there's a world of resources that they provide that are going to keep people, especially practicing lawyers, subscribing to those kind of services. So I don't think they're too worried.
What about Google Scholar? How should we think about them and what role their role Google is playing in this? Because that's, you know, sometimes a useful tool.
Absolutely.
Brian,
where are they getting their yes. data? Do you know how Google is getting its data? Probably the same way that JurisScraper does, right?
Well, it's a good question. I've heard people from Google Scholar speak at conferences several times, and what they say is that for at least the back catalog of stuff that they have, the older opinions, they bought it from someone who had it, and under the terms of that contract, they're not allowed to disclose from whom they bought it, and they're not allowed to give it away to anybody else, you know, for free. At least not in bulk, right? Of course, you can use Google Scholar for free, but you can't download their entire corpus like you can ours. So I think we exist in harmony with Google Scholar as well. You know, if you're looking for something on our site and you can't find it, you should certainly go check and see if you can find it in Google Scholar. I think when I've done comparisons, what I find is what Mike mentioned, that we do tend to have stuff with a sort of immediacy that almost nobody else seems worried about, right? You know, we're getting the opinions within the same hour, oftentimes, of when they're released. With a lot of other services, you might wait a day or two. We try to be transparent about what our coverage is, right? We have a coverage page you can look at and see if we don't have some intermediate appellate court in some state covered yet. We're probably working on it, but we may not have it yet, and it'll show up on that page. Whereas when you go to Google Scholar, you do a search and it just, you know, sometimes there's that number in the corner that says 200,000 results or whatever, but there's really no way in to see how far back does this go, or does it have everything, or, you know, you can't use it with any certainty that it's got the coverage that you might need.
Yeah, excellent point. One other thing that came up, just as we're having this conversation, we keep talking about pages and how much Pacer charges per page. Why are we still talking about pages, Mike, when what we're really talking about here is data?
I assume it has to do with the 1990s and Pacer being permanently stuck somewhere around the beginning of that decade.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I put this on the IRC log a minute ago, but even, you know, Pacer thinks of search results in terms of pages. And it's so, you know, when you do a search, you get charged a dime per page of results. And you don't know how many results you're going to have until your search is complete. So be very careful what you search for, because you could end up paying a lot of money if you search for a common word. This is just the way it's immediate. It's not like there's an interstitial that says, you know, that search has X results. It will cost you Y dollars. It's just, here are your results. That'll be X dollars, please.
Ah!
Right.
That's terrifying.
It's insane. And it's just, I could see how it made sense at the time.
Yeah, I did a search on Pacer for reasonable once and then had to take out a second mortgage on our home. Didn't seem so reasonable.
I think that has to be our second MCLE passphrase for the show before we go ahead and move on. Let's make it unreasonable search, because
and then they came and did an unreasonable seizure on my credit card account.
All right, second phrase, unreasonable search. Let us move on to some other copyright issues outside the realm of court documents and inside the realm of entertainment. So I don't have too much to go through here. One bit of bad news for people who are Groove Shark subscribers. If that is your music service of choice, obviously they've had their problems over the years with the RIAA. And it looks like it looked temporarily like they were getting through some of those problems and they were going to be officially available on Chromecast. But it looks like that's not going to happen anymore, that Google had to pull the rug out from under that, citing terms of service, violations. The RIAA commented to NextWeb that GrooveShark, they said something about GrooveShark infringing still, and made a little snide comment about the Google YouTube Viacom litigation. And so it looks like, sadly, if you're a GrooveShark person and you like Chromecast, it's not, you're not completely out of luck. You can still, as GrooveShark is quick to point out, use GrooveShark on Chromecast by going to their main site or their HTML5 mobile site. But they're not going to have that nice integration that, say, YouTube and Netflix have. Mike, do you have any thoughts on this?
I don't know. I sort of looked at it and I said, yeah, RIAA is up to their usual shenanigans, right? I don't know. It's been how many decades now that we've had technology making our lives better and the RIAA working their damnedest to stunt that? I looked at it. That's kind of how I was thinking on it.
All right. Brian, anything to add?
No, that's about right. I mean, I have a Chromecast myself. It never occurred to me to try to use it with GrooveShark, so I'm maybe not affected by this
you
directly.
You might think about it now, yeah.
Yeah. Now I'm wondering what I lost that I didn't even know I had.
Yeah.
No, nothing to add.
Nothing to add. Evan, I'm guessing that's you too. Shall we move on?
Yeah, I mean, GrooveShark just still seems like this strange animal. I'm not quite sure how it's still existing because it seems like some of the stuff it does seems questionable. So every few months it seems to come up with stories. I hadn't really thought about it too long, or, you know, it had been a long time. So, and I was surprised that there was this, at least for a while, this synergy going on between Google via Chromecast and GrooveShark. So. I just expect something. You know, we got to see, get some of these questionable practices that GrooveShark seems to be exhibiting resolved someday, somehow, perhaps.
Right. Or maybe, you know, with the various and sundry other music services out there, it will finally just slink away. Go ahead, Mike.
I was thinking a part of this has got to be the, you know, the Streisand syndrome or whatever it is as a business model.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Streisand effect is a business model.
Right. Just create a storm, get the free PR that comes along with it. Oh, I'm sorry. Was that illegal that time? Okay. 2 weeks later.
You could be onto it because you know, I mean, there's so many other ways that people are getting their music these days that seem to be, you know, having a comfortable, if not strange bedfellows kind of relationship with the music industry these days. So, and along those lines, the MPAA and the RIAA have changed their elementary school copyright curriculum. I forget which episode of the show it was that we talked about this on. It was something like a year ago, Evan, I think, when they came out with this kind of, you know, I mean, not too surprising given the source, but a sort of partisan doctrinaire sample copyright curriculum for public schools in the U.S. And I think, you know, I remember having the discussion on that show that it's a good idea to educate kids about copyright and encourage them to create. They all are running around at a certain age with devices in their hands that, you know, whether it's a GoPro or a phone or whatever it is they're using, they're just maybe their desktop provided at their school. To be able to create a lot of stuff and, you know, how it is that they can make use of that, share their work if they want to. The excellent news via Torrent Freak is that, and Torrent Freak is taking full credit for having called them out on the copyright curriculum that initially was made available, and I think it was leaked at the time, if I'm remembering correctly. Now it has been, since people kind of got up in arms about that and said, hey, there's this little thing called fair use, you might want to mention that. Not only does the sample curriculum mention fair use now, it also mentions things like Creative Commons and seems to do a much nicer job of creating a balanced view of the copyright system that exists that these students will be working within with their creations. The whole crux of the teaching endeavor is called Be a Creator. So it wants to encourage kids to go out and create, and it wants to educate them about their rights once they do so. Brian, as an educator, are you glad that the elementary students, if their schools adopt this curriculum, will get a leg up?
Well, so the RIAA certainly has gotten a lot of criticism in the past over curricula like this, where they present a somewhat one-sided view of copyright. And so to the extent that they're moving away from that and trying to provide more balanced materials, that's certainly a good thing. But I have elementary school students in my family, and right now I'm more worried that they don't have a music program at all in their school, right? And so that we might spend time teaching them about copyright when, you know, they only get to go to art once a week and they only get to go to science once a week, or these kinds of things strike me as a much smaller problem in the world of elementary school education right now.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Evan, you also have elementary school kids in your family. What do you think of this?
I really like that point that you just made there, Brian, because you know, there are a number of ways to do what the copyright and patent clause says, you know, to promote the progress of the arts and useful sciences or whatever it actually says there. And it seems like maybe just funding those programs in the first place so that we have content that's worth applying copyright to someday might be one thing. So, Denise, I you know, heard what you said to know this. It's excellent news that it's a more fair and balanced approach. And of course that is because we want any sort of education to actually present some semblance of reality, and in this case, the reality being, you know, what copyright law actually provides and what tools are out there in the wild to manage those rights, e.g., Creative Commons. But, you know, maybe before getting too much into the value judgment of what's going on right here, I would just sort of call into question the idea of doing this kind of indoctrination. I guess I went ahead and said it, indoctrination, you know, sort of to, as if to have a negative connotation of just this whole activity of the industry or its antagonists, those who, you know, would want to see more discussion about fair use and Creative Commons and de minimis use and public domain and all those other things that, you know, the MPAA and RIAA make, you know, cringe at, those types of notions. You know, it's like, you know, sure, I guess there's going to be there. It's better to have some discussion rather than not. But maybe this is just like sex ed and some of these other issues. Maybe this should be the responsibility of the parents. Maybe that's the soapbox I want to get up on. But what I wanted to just really throw out the question of what really should be the role of the school systems, what public or private, you know, to be teaching this kind of stuff in the first place. Just sort of something to pause and think about.
Yeah, I like the idea of kids getting a background in this. I do think that things like the fundamental music and art education should take precedence over making sure they understand all the copyright ramifications. But if this were just kind of a once a year thing and, you know, a couple of hours allocated to going over these points, and then kids who were interested could do some more investigation, I would be on board with that, because I do feel like this is an issue that affects their lives. And that, you know, I mean, we might think maybe kids just blithely go along and don't think about copyright too much. And maybe they do. But, you know, little things like the rumors of Minecraft getting acquired by Microsoft. Huge copyright overtones to how that's going to all play out. And, you know, if their favorite game suddenly no longer has mods and the people on YouTube aren't able to do their channels doing the playthroughs and stuff, I know my son would want to know why that's happening. And, you know, in my family, he would know, but I don't know that that's necessarily the case with everyone. Mike, any thoughts?
Yeah, I guess... For me, the system of copyright is really about making people, the way I understand it anyway, and I'm not a lawyer, but the way I understand it, the concept is that we have copyright to encourage people to make art. And at least in elementary school, which it sounds like what this is geared for, kids are going to make art. and it's not because they have a commercial interest. I just don't know about teaching this to people, to children, until they might have a commercial interest in it. But at the same time, I see that sort of, you know, understanding copyright at a certain level once you're like hearing about business deals or whatever and how those might have copyright ramifications. Maybe in high school, I could see understanding that. But I think framing it from, you know, you need to understand copyright in order to not infringe, which is, I assume, what they're doing here. That seems really wrong to me. Maybe if you framed it in a, you need to understand copyright so that you understand why, you know, things that seem so obvious, like giving your friend an MP3, I don't know. It's certainly not for young kids like elementary school. I think that's just kind of, you know, it's only going to make them less creative.
I think it is indicative of a shift in copyright that's occurred, say, maybe over the last 30 years or so, where technology has brought what used to be a law for industry, right? I mean, the people who needed to understand copyright law in the 80s worked for the record companies, right, and worked for big publishers, and that's about it, right? You know, the day-to-day interaction with copyright was just not something an average person would expect to deal with. But when every piece of technology you touch today is basically a copy machine, right? suddenly, right, the average person does, you know, impact or run into copyright issues when they're just posting something on YouTube or sharing an Instagram photo or whatever it is they're doing. And so the world changed underneath copyright law, and now it is relevant to our day-to-day lives. But I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing. It might suggest that it's time to revisit copyright law.
Yeah. But until that happens, you know, the RIAA is doing their part to make sure that kids understand it. Maybe, you know, others should do their part too. I thought that was a piece of good news. Obviously, you can look at that as a mixed piece of news. But for someone who's interested in the fair use doctrine, gaining more clarity and application by the federal courts, there was a good decision in a case involving a company I've never heard of before called TVEyes, which creates... Speaking of making databases of data available, do we have databases of other things? TVEyes makes a searchable database of TV and radio station broadcasts, and they were sued by Fox for copying and making their clips searchable. They sued for copyright infringement and hot news misappropriation. The hot news doctrine is something that is dying a slow and happy death and seems to have continued to do that in this case. And the court found following the Second Circuit's decision in the Authors Guild, the Google Book Search HathiTrust case, that this was fair use, that making this material searchable for analysis and research was a fair use of the works, and that copying was necessary to make that happen. So we don't get too many flat out, yes, this is fair use and this business can continue on as it is going kind of decisions. And this is one of them. So Evan, any thoughts on this one?
Well, I wish we hadn't already given both CLE phrases because I like the word moribund. You know, I had to look that one up. I'd seen that one.
Yes.
That's what you were talking about, the hot news doctrine, dying the slow death. And so I guess one of the reasons the court found that that didn't apply here is because TVEyes, which I hadn't heard of either, and I'm surprised I hadn't heard anything about this litigation because it's really interesting. TVEyes is free writing, you know, which is one of the elements of hot news. It's just holding this. It's not holding this out, this content out as its own. So It almost seems from the copyright fair use standpoint, just sort of the analysis of Google Book Search and HathiTrust, just sort of in a microcosm, actually in a little bit of different place. But, you know, you can definitely draw the analogies of what's going on here, taking content that exists in some other form and making it available for search, which is a little bit confusing here, because I think one of the issues that's actually going back down to the district court is whether and to what extent, you know, that capability of search is relevant here. So I'm not quite clear about exactly what is still at issue, but on balance, at least according to this analysis from the EFF that we saw, which included that word moribund, you know, it does seem like something very positive for fair use as a whole, in as much as, you know, as taking all this content and making it available for the transformative purposes of looking at just these clips here.
So, Brian, here's a good reason why elementary school or older children might need to know about copyright if they stumbled across a tool called TV Eyes and were involved in some kind of creative activity. And they did a search and they found a bunch of clips of, you know, things they wanted to use, put together, make a movie of some kind or a presentation. Just because they can find them doesn't mean that they're licensed to use them. So they would have their own slew of fair use hurdles to get over, correct?
Yeah, although that scenario makes me want to return to the idea that, boy, we need to revisit copyright law. If we're telling kids, you know, working on a school project or trying to learn how to be filmmakers or whatever it is they're doing, that the first thing they need to do is stop and talk to a lawyer, right? Like, that seems crazy.
Wait, what's
to
wrong
me.
With that?
it's great for us lawyers, you know, full employment for lawyers. We're going to solve the job crunch for new graduates in this way. But
hope so.
This is a really interesting case because it comes out of the Southern District of New York, and the Second Circuit is a hotbed of fair use decisions recently, with the HathiTrust decision and also the Google Books case. Those two prior decisions in the Second Circuit suggest that this, you know, ought to be upheld if it's appealed. But it's in this category of cases where we see people providing an information location tool, a search engine, or something like that. And so much like the old Perfect 10 v. Amazon case out of the Ninth Circuit, we find that these kinds of tools, courts are willing to find them to be fair use. Sometimes even paradigmatic fair uses, right? That they're so transformative that they're exactly what this doctrine is supposed to be all about, right? You have courts making really grand proclamations like that in some of these cases. So that's interesting. And then the hot news angle on this, you might remember from a couple of years ago, it was also the Second Circuit that had the fly on the wall case in the financial services industry. You know, access to these research reports about a given stock or company are hot news. It was in that case that we saw a little resurgence of, oh, is this doctrine coming back? And then it was sort of the kibosh was put on it. But it's all happening in the Second Circuit. So that's the place to watch for these issues, apparently, right now.
I think Simon and Garfunkel did a song about that once. Mike, any thoughts?
No, Brian taught me everything I know about IP law, so I defer to him on all issues of this type.
Yes. Can I digress?
Simon and Garfunkel wrote a song about
it. Yeah, this is when the decade gap between Evan and I becomes apparent, because I remember the Simon and Garfunkel song, It's All Happening at the Zoo, and he doesn't.
I've got their greatest hits. I only know Bridge Over Troubled Water, Sound of Silence, just the classics, you know.
And right.
That, it took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw, but anyway.
Oh, good one. Yeah, that's a more obscure track. All right. Okay. I wanted to ask you guys before we move on. This is just a bit of a digression, but I think it's UC Berkeley School of Information has always fascinated me because it is a whole school devoted to information science, et cetera. And I seem to run across it frequently being here in California. Are there a lot of other schools that specialize in that area? Or are you guys kind of out there in the woods?
There are. The history of the school at Cal, anyway, is it was originally the library school. And then there was a time when libraries were facing a lot of challenges and technology was changing and the internet came along. And it was time to reinvent themselves, really. And at first, the school was known as the School of Information Management Systems, or SIMS. But then there grew up a lot of these similar programs at various colleges across the country, and they started calling themselves iSchools or Schools of Information. And so Berkeley looked at that and said, oh, yeah, that's us too. And so then there was the last change to be just the School of Information. But it is really interesting. You know, it's a master's and PhD program. We don't currently have an undergraduate degree, although some schools are doing that sort of thing. And we bring together economists and political scientists and computer scientists and lawyers like me and so on to look at these information issues from those diverse perspectives. And the students come out, you know, really well-rounded and capable like Mike. I like to always mention that Mike came to the iSchool as an English major. But yet now he spends his days, you know, writing code and developing software. We teach people enough technical skills to make them dangerous.
Yeah, and I'm guessing, I mean, I was an English major too, and I think if I were doing things all over again, I might have gone to iSchool instead of law school in today's day and age with legal careers, as you pointed out, not having that great of an opportunity to employ yourself after you graduate. Are you seeing more and more people who you think might have taken the other track come your way instead?
Sometimes, yeah. Just met a student, you know, we're just starting classes this fall semester, and he told me that he had considered going to law school, but chose our program instead. So that is a calculation that some students are making when they have policy-based interests. Our iSchool, I think, actually stands out if that's your leaning. There are some iSchools that are much more technically focused. So if you're interested in user interfaces and the usability of a system, there are some schools that might be better to go to for that. But we have two lawyers in our small faculty. And so, you know, those people who are jazzed about privacy and copyright and cyber law and these kinds of things, we're a pretty good place to touch on those interests.
What do you think, Mike? Is your iSchool degree more marketable than a law school degree would be in today's day and age?
All I know is that all my lawyer friends are struggling. That's in the San Francisco area, just lots of firms shutting down and the recession being unkind. But I had a fantastic time at the School of Information, and you know, I recommend it really, really highly. It just gives you, like Brian's saying, you know, the technology background, and it gives you the, you know, there's a sociology component, there's a policy component, there's a, you know, UI design component. Anywhere that technology touches our lives, like, you know, how did telephones change, you know, society 100 years ago? Well, how are cell phones changing society now? All of these things. It's a wonderful program, I think.
Well, I think that's a really good segue into talking about the Apple announcements this week, which I'm going to approach from a privacy standpoint. So, you know, all the ways in which technology and data impact our lives, Apple wants to impact them even more than it already has in those areas with its announcements this week about its two new iPhones, its Apple Watch, and its new pay system. So all of these are going to put Apple more in the business of managing and keeping track of and allowing people to make use of data about them, both financial and health-wise, in the case of the pay system and the health apps that will be part of the watch. So what do you think of this, Mike? Is Apple the company that we want to have in the data management business? They haven't shown a great track record of security soundness to date, but Tim Cook's comments resonated with me that, you know, well, we're not trying to sell you stuff. We're not going to look at this data. We, you know, all we sell is hardware. We're not going to be targeting you or selling your data. We're just helping you make use of it. Is he just trying to put a good spin on things, do you think?
I think it's a tough one. It's a bit of a double-edged sword. I do think of Apple as, you know, primarily a hardware company. And that's great because maybe they're not going to be as likely to look at your content, although I'm skeptical of that. But on the other hand, that also means that you have this like celebrity, you know, photo leak scandal. You know, their reputation for pulling off online services is not as good as, say, Google's. I think I'm not positive of that. But it's that celebrity leak couldn't have come at a worse time for them. And I think putting all this like health data and, you know, like these watches, I think have sensors on the backside that you can turn on in theory. But it's interesting, right? That it's going to go farther and farther. It's sooner or later they'll be monitoring the contents of our blood, probably that kind of thing. And you know, how long is it going to be till they know you're pregnant? There's already blood tests to do that. Do you want Apple knowing that? Do you want anyone knowing that? It's an interesting sort of situation we're moving into.
Well, I guess Tim Cook's argument is better for Apple to know you're pregnant than Target, because Target's going to start sending you diaper ads and things, and Apple's just not. At least not now.
I don't know. I mean, once that data is in their cloud, I have declared bankruptcy on knowing where it's going to go next.
Right.
You know, and how long are they going to store it, and who are they going to give it to? Who have I said they could give it to? Probably everybody. I've given up staying ahead of that curve. I think it's just sort of once the data is in their cloud, it's gone. It's theirs, and I have no control. I don't think that's a good situation, just to be clear.
I'll toss it out to the three of you. Me, personally, haven't worn a watch since I've had a smartphone. Right? I mean, I'm not dying to wear a watch. The phone has replaced all of my watch-related functions, and I think I would need a watch to replace all of my phone-related functions before I left the phone at home and just went around with a watch on. Maybe for men, it's a different thing. Before the show, I was chatting with someone in IRC that said watches are the only, you know, sort of societally acceptable way for a straight guy to wear jewelry. you know, are you guys excited to have a more effective multifunction watch on your wrist? What do you think, Evan?
I haven't yet seriously considered, or I haven't, you know, considered seriously enough actually getting one to sort of think of it from the aesthetic, cosmetic level, if you will. I mean, I can see where it would be handy for certain things, and certainly not very good for others. I'm still trying to just visualize what it will be like to actually generate content using a watch. I think it'd be very difficult to actually expect to manually enter text or anything like that. So to the extent that there are features, you know, with what Siri can allow you to do, or other, you know, ways to generate or ways to generate content, you know, to send content, to generate and distribute that, that's going to be questionable. So what I see the real interesting aspect of it here is the ability to capture biometric data to enhance one's ability to capture and collect data for the quantified self. And from what I get on that, the it's still sort of unclear how much of a hook that's going to be for people. So what we see with the Apple Watch and with the Apple Pay, and I do want to just sort of dog ear that notion, talk about some branding when we get to that notion. I mean, what we see here is Apple doing some very intriguing things by entering into two spaces that are very privacy volatile areas, health data, the data about one's biology and physical state, and financial data. And I really think they're saying the right things. And I'm sure they would be, you know, Tim Cook didn't change plans just in the last week about how all this stuff is going to work or really what the messaging was going to be, I'm sure, in light of the Jennifer Lawrence and others, the privacy scandal, that may have actually, there might be a little bit of a silver lining on that, because what that privacy concern of last week with the unauthorized access of this content in the iCloud infrastructure really allows what Tim Cook's messaging is in terms of privacy to stand in stark contrast. For example, all the health data with the development of HealthKit and all the tools that will allow developers to develop apps with the Apple Watch, for example, is not permitted to be stored in the iCloud. It can be stored in some other cloud service, but not in iCloud. And from what I understand, it's going to be encrypted, you know, on the device itself. And then of course, with the payment system, the near field communications, I don't see why that's not going to be head and shoulders above ordinary credit card transactions. Because there's not going to be the actual disclosure of a particular credit card number to the vendor anymore. Situations like the Target breach and the Home Depot breach and all that are going to go away because of the near field communication and the way that the interface or the interaction, the interchange of that payment goes. So the messaging is right on, saying all the good things in light of the particularized concerns that we have seen in the last year. The big privacy stories are Target, Home Depot, Jennifer Lawrence. Those things seem to be pretty adequately addressed in the announcements, in the design, and certainly the messaging for it.
Brian, what do you think? You're there at Ground Zero. You both are, Mike and Brian, in the Bay Area. Are you going to be running out and health kitting your arm and letting people tap you on the wrist and, you know, paying for your Pete's coffee with Apple Pay?
It's a little disingenuous for Tim to say that they're just a hardware company. They've been a services company as well for a long time, right? I mean, iTunes is a service that allows me to pay for MP3s, and iCloud is a service that I can pay a little bit extra to get more storage space. And now with Apple Pay, that's going to be a service, right, you know, that they're offering to people. And I think it is the bigger announcement. I mean, the new iPhone 6s, okay, those are interesting, but there's going to be a 7 sooner or later, and it'll be forgotten. The Apple Watch, you know, is interesting to some people. I don't know. I'm sort of with Evan on, I'm trying to imagine how my interaction with that is going to be less frustrating than I already am frustrated trying to type messages on a phone. You know, that. So there's maybe a niche market for that sort of thing, but if they interject themselves into, you know, payment systems and it's successful, that's a really big deal and could become a really big business for them, I think. I read an article where somebody was sort of discounting the convenience factor and saying, look, I have to drag my wallet out and get my credit card, and this is, you know, posed as some insurmountable obstacle, you know, paying with a credit card, and it's actually, in their eyes, not that bad. Now I have to, you know, dig around for my phone and get that out and pay. They didn't see convenience as the selling factor. And that there may be something to that, but Evan's right to point out if there is a security enhancement, then that could be a selling point. I really want to see the thing work in action, because I don't know if you've been at the airport where people have the mobile boarding passes, and they get up to the scanner and they can't quite get it to scan. And, you know, they turn the phone this way and that way, and no, let's try and zoom it. And you're standing in line behind them, you know, wanting to throttle them, wishing they just had a paper.
With your paper boarding, you know, pass, yeah.
Exactly, right. You know, so sometimes these allegedly convenient systems in practice don't work out. So let's wait and see if it's as convenient as time. But it, I think, was the biggest announcement of the ones that they made this week.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I guess, is it Passbook or Passport? I forget what Apple calls that, where you can add things. Passbook, where you can add things to that feature. And then what's supposed to happen is, you know, it's supposed to make your life easier. It's supposed to, I've never once had it happen where it popped up on my screen when I walked into the airport and was ready to use. I always have to, you know, go three screens deep into the phone and find the dang boarding pass. And I've been that person who, you know, everyone behind me in line is going, come on, just print the thing out at home. But yeah. I do think that, you know, we were talking earlier about how, excruciating it is for people to get their documents from Pacer in a non-electronic way, and they have to fax and do the, you know, use these antiquated technologies to accomplish things. Anyone who has done a refinance or a home loan in the recent past, it feels like you're time traveling. It feels like you're going back to a time when, you know, maybe pre-fax machine, when maybe you would get out your fountain pen to scrawl your name on a 2-inch high stack of documents, and none of which you have read. So I do like people have been, I think, giving Apple the knock that they're not innovating enough here, but pushing forward in both these fronts, I think, is pretty innovative and is getting us away from those antiquated ways of doing things. I just hope that, you know, they implement it properly and don't have the kinds of privacy headaches that could be inherent in managing this data. Any last thoughts? I'll go around. Mike?
He just sent a chat message saying that he dropped out and he's reconnected, but can't seem to get back into the call.
Yeah, we're getting Mike back in right now.
Okay. How about you, Brian?
No, that you've covered it.
All righty. I think the last thing that we'll cover today, well, let me ask you, I definitely want to cover the net neutrality internet slowdown that we saw this week, but we have some other things in the rundown. I just want to make sure if we skip them, no one is sad about that. Hasn't been dying to talk about it. Evan, any of the other stories catch your eye that you really want to talk about?
I don't have it right in front of me here, but
let me tell you what they are.
There's Dead Mouse.
There's Dead Mouse, which we skipped from last week. Let's talk about Dead Mouse then. That's a trademark story, so we have no bumper to play for it, but we shelved it from last week. It's a trademark issue that involves Dead Mouse's logo that looks like Disney mouse ears. I haven't paid too much attention to it, Evan, so maybe you better bring us up to speed.
Sure. Well, you know, Dead Mouse, the electronic musician, I thought of him as a dubstep artist, and I was corrected that that's not entirely accurate, although you might characterize it in that genre. So, sorry. Mm-hmm. You know, he is well known for performing in this big costumed head that is spherical in shape and has two large ears, and it resembles, abstractly at least, a mouse, and, you know, clearly is reminiscent of Mickey Mouse. Nobody's going to, I think, actually mistake and think that it's Mickey Mouse, but, you know, there is a pretty detailed level a resemblance here. And so he's been around for years, and Disney hasn't really done too much about it up to this point. He has he enjoys trademark registrations in a number of other countries. And so in mid-August, he filed in the USPTO, the U.S. United States Patent and Trademark Office, an application to register the a logo, which is the outline of the mouse head that he uses, a large spherical head and then the two round ears. And then underneath that is the word Dead Mouse. And it's, of course, DEADMAU5. And then it has kind of like the eyes in it as well. But and it's for a pretty broad list of goods and services, including clothing and, of course, services, the performance of a live musical performances and things like that. So what the issue is that he has filed this application to seek registration of that trademark and service mark in the USPTO, and Disney has taken issue with that aspect of it. Sent him the cease and desist letter shortly after he filed the application. What sort of makes it then interesting is that he found on a Disney website a situation where Disney was making one of his audio tracks available for remix, I think a video as well. Disney has responded to that, saying that that was licensed. So there's sort of some issue there. But essentially, Deadmau5 is sort of firing back, fighting a trademark allegation with a copyright allegation. So these things, you know, may or may not, or, you know, will not necessarily cancel each other out. It's sort of just a lot of fighting and going on here. So I think a couple of different issues that arise from this is, you know, what's the appropriate way of thinking about this from the legal standpoint? And I've certainly got some thoughts to share on that, on the substantive trademark issues. But I think the other interesting aspect to think of this is, you know, how are we supposed to think of these things when it's a large corporate interest against what I think people perceive as sort of the little guy here, though, although Deadmau5 is wildly successful and, you know, probably makes money hand over fist, I'm sure. You know, we've got this sort of theater going on of Deadmau5 in the position of taking aim at, you know, what he characterizes as bullying big corporate tactics. So it's interesting to see all this play out and all the issues that come out from that.
Well, you just published your article on your firm site about trademark. Do any of those principles come into play here to give us some insights onto how this might come out?
I don't think you have to get too nuanced in trademark law to see how this, you know, or at least how I think this should come out. Because one thing we got to make clear here is that Disney, in response to what Deadmau5 said about his copyright allegations here, is that Disney is not complaining about Deadmau5's use of the costume and the performing in the costume that he does, the big mouse head. What it's concerned about here is protecting its trademark interests in the United States, because he's actually seeking registration for that. And if you get a trademark registration in the United States, you get a lot of these wonderful benefits. Among them are that you are presumably the owner of the exclusive rights to use that mark in connection with the goods and services that are listed in the application anywhere in the United States. And so what an examiner at the trademark office does, and this is a similar analysis that you would do in litigation over trademark infringement, is examine whether there is a likelihood of confusion, whether a member of the consuming public is going to be confused as to where these goods and services are come from. And when the examiner at the trademark office is looking at the application, it just looks at what's in the application. The examiner's under no obligation to go out into the real world and see how the mark's actually being used. It looks at the mark that's in the drawing in the application and the services that are there. And Deadmau5's logo that he's applying for looks a lot more like Mickey Mouse than does the head he wears when he's performing. So I would encourage anybody to go to the USPTO website. It's pretty easy to do a search there if you just search for Deadmau5, spelling it correctly, you know, and the services there. You know, it really does look a lot like Mickey Mouse, more so than what, you know, sort of the overall general commercial impression is. So I'm on the side of Disney when it comes to this, but that's not to discount sort of the overall theater that's going on here about what's the appropriate action on either side. But as far as a pure trademark analysis goes here, you don't have to go any further than just thinking of this idea of the likelihood of confusion to have some thoughts about this.
Brian, is there a fair use principle that comes into play in this as well with trademark? Or is the USPTO going to look at the fact that this is a transformative use of, if they go ahead and decide that it does resemble the mouse logo that Disney has?
So I'm not familiar with the Deadmau5's performances or music. And so I'm not sure it feels like when he chooses that costume that there's some sort of commentary being made about Mickey Mouse or Disney or corporate, you know, entities generally or something, you know. Maybe there's if there is a parody going on here or something like that, that's, you know, worth looking into. But I guess I tend a little bit more towards Deadmau5's reaction so far on this, that the idea that there really could be a likelihood of confusion going either direction, right? If we imagine that Deadmau5 gets this park. And then what? He's going to try and sue Disney if Mickey Mouse ever appears in a cartoon as a DJ or something? You know, I don't see that working out very well for him. And if Disney were to try to allege that what Dead Mouse is up to the extent that I'm familiar with that, you know, somehow could create a likelihood of confusion with their marks, I don't see it. And so they're similar. One may even be commentary on the other. But is there a likelihood of confusion? I don't think so.
I don't know how we can work the word earmark into the discussion here, but it seems like it belongs somewhere. Evan, what about is there any sort of fair use commentary, transformation, parody principle that should come into play here?
I don't think there's going to be the opportunity for that to come into this particular dispute here, because if you'll remember a few months ago when we were talking about the Washington Redskins brouhaha, everybody was like, oh, this is just such a huge deal, when actually the legal issue is very, very narrow, because there's actually no proceeding that's been filed here. This is just a cease and desist letter that Disney sent in response to Dead Mouse having filed a trademark application. So the next logical step would be that once the application travels along in the path at the USPTO, it hasn't even been assigned to an examiner yet. That takes like 3 or 4 months before it, you know, the examiners get down and deep enough into the pile to get to actually start reviewing the thing. So the next logical step is that there would be an opposition proceeding in the United States Patent and Trademark Office before the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board. And the jurisdiction of the TTAB is very limited. All it can do is give a thumbs up or a thumbs down as to whether the registrations should issue. It doesn't have the subject matter jurisdiction to award money damages or issue an injunction or anything like that. So, you know, it's likely the next step will just be a very narrow set of legal issues. And in that context, there really won't be any room or space or opportunity for discussion of fair use, because the examiner is, like I said earlier, limited to just what's in the application and not the examiner is not supposed to look at, and the TTAB is not supposed to look at anything really in reality except what's actually in the application, because of the narrow question that's before them. So I realize I'm sort of giving a long-winded answer, but it's really just to sort of set in contrast to what would happen if there were actual litigation, where if Disney were to go to court against Dead Mouse and say, stop using your mark in commerce in connection with these goods or services, Dead Mouse would then have the opportunity to say, well, this is a classic fair use. And I really don't know how, you know, we would get there, because the sort of fair use that you see in trademarks, I don't think is here. He's actually just trying to use his own mark in connection with his own service. He's not making any comparisons to Disney. Maybe there could be evidence to come out that he's trying to make some kind of, statement about Mickey Mouse. But I haven't seen that in the commentary so far. And it just doesn't seem likely that Disney would be interested in doing a whole lot of stuff like that based on what they've said so far with, they came right out and said in a public statement that they don't object to him using the costume, which leads to think that there may be just some narrow concern here on this proceeding in the trademark office. So ultimately, I think academically it's interesting to think about, but right now there's really no opportunity for fair use other than just us kicking it around right here, I guess.
Right. Well, all these academic legal issues are well and good, but I have to ask Mike, because he, I think, is our youngster on the show today. What the heck is up with all these people with their fake heads in music these days? We've got Dead Mouse. We've got the Frank Fassbender. Is that the guy who wears the huge head mask? And there's Daft Punk. What? Why the heads?
I can't speak for any generation on the head topic, but I will say that the horse heads seem to be going away. So that's good.
That's good. All right. Wonderful. You may have noticed, and this is on the legislation and policy front, just to let you guys know, this would be where our bumper plays.
And you can't miss this one.
Thank you. You might have noticed on Wednesday a bunch of spinning, please wait kind of messages around the internet. It was internet slowdown day, much like in SOPA. This was the internet's effort to bring awareness on the part of the general public to the net neutrality issue. I saw spinning please wait icons all around the web that day. What I didn't get a good impression of is if people were actually slowing down the delivery of their sites. Mike, do you think that happened? And what do you think of the whole protest? Did it do its job?
I don't know. I think from what I heard, it seemed like most people weren't actually going to slow things down. It was sort of just like, this is what it would be like.
Right.
Which we all know what it's like because we all have cell phones with the internet on them and it's slow. Mm-hmm. But did it work? Who knows? I mean, I was looking at the FCC comments. Sunlight did a nice like analysis of the comments they've gotten already. And it's overwhelming. The public, like, we want net neutrality. But are we going to get what we want? I don't know. There have already been, like, what, 80,000 comments from the public. Is that going to be enough weight on one side of the scale to overrule Comcast and whoever else is wanting to do this two-tier thing? I don't know. Did it work? We'll find out. But I know they got a lot of comments. I know I made a comment yesterday. I saw, you know, I think Vimeo had a real great, like, sort of interstitial pop-up, if you watched any of their videos yesterday. And it said, like, this is what it would be like. And they had, like, a jittery video that was sort of fake jitters. And it was done really, really well. And it put you immediately in touch with your congressperson. But will it work? I don't know. Comcast is strong. They got their fingers in a lot of pockets.
Right. Fletcher Babb, at least over at VentureBeat, thought that the whole notion of just showing you the spinning circle and not slowing things down wasn't really making the point. He thought it was, the headline says, a bogus, empty gesture without actually putting any teeth into it. Evan, what do you think?
Oh, isn't that just link bait? You know, come on. Doing something is better than nothing. You know, I mean,
yes.
I didn't have the ambition to get out of bed and then think of some campaign like this. So I'm glad somebody did to raise awareness to the issue. I mean, you know, I get sort of cynical about the whole network neutrality, open internet debate in the first place. I don't get so cynical about the issue. I think it's critically important, but I just get cynical about a lot of the commentary because it seems so polarized and it's so difficult to find a reasonable discussion about all the different interests at stake here. It's just in this particular campaign, it was just like, you know, cable, the cable side, bad, the internet side, good. And, you know, as if that's just black versus white, dark, you know what I mean? Just very, very, you know, stark contrast, polarizing dispute. Same way with, we were talking about last week, the video with the people riding around Manhattan on toilets.
Right.
You know, it's just that it's just so easy to parody a lot of this stuff in ways that I just think reinforce stereotypes and just isn't helpful ultimately for the discussion. So it's for that reason why I get very cynical about sort of the commentary on this in general. But goodness, it's better to engage in the communication and the conversation, even if done not perfectly, then to not do it at all. And I wouldn't take the side of throwing stones at you know, any attempt at that, even if I don't think that it's like perfectly executed.
Yeah, I agree with you on both points. And we have tried, and we've had a number of guests on all sides of the issue on the show over the months since the Verizon decision. And I think if they have shown us nothing, it's that it's a very complicated and nuanced issue, and the polarized points of the spectrum don't necessarily tell the whole story. And so anything that gets people reading about it and trying to wrap their head around it and trying to give productive feedback to the FCC and their lawmakers on, you know, their take and what they're afraid could happen and how they want the internet to function and what feels like fundamentally required access and minimum levels of service is a productive thing. So, Brian, anything to add?
Yeah, I think, you know, to the extent they wanted the slowdown day to mirror the blackout that we had to fight SOPA and PIPA, it didn't feel like it was as big of an event, experiencing it anyway, but maybe the proof will be in the pudding. If we actually see some sort of result from this in the coming weeks, then maybe we'll view it as a really important protest. But it is a thorny issue. You know, people want to go on and comment and say, you know, some sort of polarizing thing, when you wish there were a way to get people to say, well, what we need is Title II reclassification as a common carrier, but we don't want the FCC to overreach. And, you know, it gets so in the weeds of telecom law so quickly.
Yeah, it does.
But because, I mean, actually, for me to be happy with the result of this, I actually think the FCC needs to thread a pretty narrow needle, right? I mean, I am one of these people who's very worried about the cable companies overreaching and acting as extortionists and, you know, trying to get money out of Netflix when I've already paid for my connection and, you know, and you know, that's a concern, right? But also, the FCC is not an organization that I trust to be in charge of the internet, right? You know, they have been a agency that over years has been subject to capture, usually by the industries that they regulate. And so we don't want an outcome from all of this that, you know, makes them the new internet cops, because I don't know what they'll do next, right? You know, so it's
right, or from administration to administration,
right? So it is a tough technical issue. And we'll see how much this slowdown protest gets us towards that optimal solution.
Yeah, Evan, refresh my memory. When the SOPA and PIPA protests took place, didn't big sites like Wikipedia, I know Reddit was a spearhead of that, didn't they go completely dark that day?
Yeah, indeed. And that was, you know, terribly disruptive, because I like to look up, you know, like a bunch of random Bolshevik trivia, and, you know, so it was very, very difficult. So yes. Yeah, a lot different.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, you never know what protests are to come. Perhaps we can all look forward to our internet slowing down in order to raise awareness. But let's hope it doesn't slow down in any kind of permanent way. Let's move on to our tip and resource of the week and get you started on your weekends. Our tip of the week struck me as interesting. It's a piece over at Tech Dirt where Mike Masnick is reminding people that cell site location data is not very accurate. It only provides you with sort of a wide range of where a person might be. It doesn't pinpoint where that person might be. And he used as his rant starting point an Economist article that gave some examples of cell site location data being used in to convict people, and in one terrible, terrible case, keep a woman in prison for 12 years based on the argument by the prosecutors in her case that she could be pinpointed at the location where her, I think it was her roommate or somebody, was killed. And so she felt like, you know, hamstrung and had to plead out. And who knows, you know, there was never a trial, so we have no idea what the actual facts are there. But the fact is that cell site data is often used by law enforcement lawyers, as Mike puts it, law enforcement lawyers, prosecutors, and judges, as something that's terribly, terribly accurate about where you might be, when in fact that's not the case. And Mike looks forward to the day when people recognize that on a wider basis. So we're helping get the word out about that. GPS allows for much more precise targeting. But what I have personally discovered is that the GPS on a cell phone is not as accurate as a GPS on a GPS-oriented device. And I'm not sure why that is the case. I'm not technical enough to understand why you can't have accurate GPS on a cell phone, but that's not what we're talking about, cell site location data. Do our information school guys have any thoughts on this? Brian?
I'm not familiar with cell phone location data, and so I read it with interest, but don't have a comment.
All right, Mike?
Yeah, I was a little surprised by that because I thought that you could use the combination of the signal strengths at several different towers to get a much more accurate picture. But
yeah, he addresses that. You're talking about triangulation?
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
Yeah. So
that's
yes.
Not as good as I think it is. Okay.
No, that's good. And oh, okay. Mike points out that's good. But apparently people are, you know, evidentially this data is being used just from one tower. And from one tower, yeah. You really only know where someone is in a broad area. Yeah. If you can watch their progress from tower to tower to tower, you can tell what direction they're going. But again, you can't pinpoint their location. So something to bear in mind. And our resource of the week is, surprise, surprise, courtlistener.org and Recap. So Court Listener is where you can go and search the database of federal materials. It's not just federal, is it? You guys have all the state materials in here too.
Yep.
Everything you've been able to put in here so far. So it's searchable, it's fast, it has very current information as compared to some of the tools that you might find out all there. It's not all that comprehensive yet, but it is a work in progress and a great tool. Anything else you want to add about Court Listener? Just as background for our resource of the week here, Mike?
It's courtlistener.com, but other than that, no, I think that's a great summary.
And recapthelaw.org is the browser extension for Firefox and Chrome. Any other browsers that it works with?
We're working on Internet Explorer, but it's not out yet.
Well, see, once you get it on IE, then you'll capture that whole lawyer user.
That's the hope.
That's right.
And actually, if there are IE users out there right now, we need some beta testers for the IE extension. So get in touch.
Nobody's going to admit it.
All the law firms that are still using IE. All right. So the great resources. Wonderful to have you guys here with us. Really fascinating discussion of the work that you're doing and the history leading up to where we are, how we got where we are with Pacer. So definitely keep up the great work. It's been so great having you on the show, Brian Carver. Any events or goings on at the iSchool that you want to leave us with before we get on out of here?
No, I generally tell people that the first Thursday in May each year is when the final project showcase is and the master students show off what they've been working on. And if you're in Berkeley at that time, that's the best way to understand what happens at an iSchool that there is just seeing the presentations of these projects that the students have worked on for so long.
Really cool. Thank you for that. Yeah. Mike Listener, thanks so much for joining us as well.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure.
We've learned a ton. Evan, this has been a really fun show, huh?
Sure has. Yeah, really interesting to talk about these different things. So I've enjoyed a lot. So it's been a lot of fun to be here. You're always asking the questions, Denise. What do you got going on coming up on your radar?
I don't have anything coming up on my radar. I'm I do the show and I represent a few clients, and I don't have any speaking coming up. I would love to get out and do a little bit more speaking. I haven't been doing it much lately because the invitations I've been getting, it's not because I haven't been getting invitations, but I've been getting invitations to go to the East Coast, which is very difficult for me to do. Southern California, Northern California, I can make it too much easier. So go ahead if you're having an event and want someone to talk about technology law, think about me because I'd like to go do that. Other than that, just cranking along, trying to, I spring clean in the fall. So that's what's been on my agenda these days is getting rid of junk. I'll turn to more intellectual matters once that's all over and done with. But thanks for asking, Evan. What else shall we leave you with? We're recording this show on Friday, and that's when we always record the show. We start at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. If you would like to join us live, that's when you should do so. Go to twit.tv and click the Watch Live Now link, and that's how you can join us live. You can jump into IRC with us while we record and heckle us, give us questions, give us resources. We love to interact with our audience during and after the shows. After the shows, the best way to get in touch with us is either by email. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. Or we are both on the Twitter. He is Internet Cases there. I'm D Howell there. And I find that my most common use of Twitter these days is interacting with people about the show there. You know, I don't so much use Twitter as my news or information sources I used to, but it's sure useful to talk about the show and develop themes for the show. So keep feeding us stuff there. Also, we have a Facebook page at facebook.com/thisweekinlaw, youtube.com/thisweekinlaw as well for the archive of shows in case you've missed a live one or want to go back to one of the great old ones. Figure out what the RIAA and MPAA wanted to teach our kids, you know, a year back. That show is there somewhere. What else should I tell you? Google Plus is another place where you can get in touch with us because we have both a community and a page over there. So we hope you've enjoyed the show. We hope you'll come back next week when we do this all again on This Week in Law. Take care.